Hi, Myron. I am an alcoholic. I apologize to many of you that have heard me speak before. This is truly same song, second verse, a little bit louder, quite a bit worse. I tried to come up with a different story, but I'm not that creative. So, what I'm going to do is paraphrase a little bit from page 29 of this book. Each individual in his personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. This is gives a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in my life. I hope that no one will consider these self-revealing accounts, this self-revealing account, to be in bad taste. My hope is that many alcoholic men and women who are desperately in need will hear what I have to say, and it is only by fully disclosing myself and my problems that they might be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. My sobriety date is April 4th, 1984, and I am fortunate to have as my home group the men and women that set up this, the many of the people who are here today at the Living Serious group in at Lake of the Woods. I was born and raised in a dairy farm about 2.5 miles north of a town of 125 people. This was in northern Minnesota. All the people in that community were descendants, when I was there, were descendants of the Swedish immigrants that came to Minnesota in the 1870s and 1880s. Including two sets of my great-grandparents. My dad's parents were both born in Sweden and came over in the 1890s. During the 1870s and 1880s in Sweden, there was in the Lutheran Church in Sweden, there was a revival movement that was going on that was called Swedish Pietism, which was meant to increase the piety of the people. So when they brought their churches to America, the churches in the area that I grew up in were very heavily influenced by Swedish Pietism. By the time that it got to me, you know, three generations later, there was a lot of legalism to it. So some of the very sinful things were drinking, smoking, dancing, playing cards with faces on them. Those were all things that were very, very sinful to, when I was growing up. I was raised in a very religious family, from the time that I was about that high, I was going to be a minister. My grandma and grandpa lived on the farm just west of ours, and my grandpa got very crippled from arthritis, and so he was kind of homebound, and the pastor that was there at that time would come and see him, and I had very much hero worship of that man, of Pastor Erickson, and I intended to be a minister. I went to a two-room schoolhouse. Grades 1 through 4 were in one room, and 5 through 8 were in the other. Can you imagine those poor teachers that had to do that? All of us were descendants of those Swedish immigrants, so we were all little blonde-haired, little blue-eyed boys and girls, and we all kind of looked alike. I don't remember exactly where it was and when it was, but it was sometime, I would say probably when I was around 10 or 11, that I came to realize that I was not like a lot of the other little boys. And you have to remember, you know, 60 some years ago in rural Minnesota, we hadn't had a TV very many years at that point. I certainly had no means of defining what I was feeling. And I just knew that I was different. And so being the religious little boy that I was, I went to the Bible to try to find some way to deal with what I was feeling. And I got to Leviticus, and I found something that was as close to what I was feeling, and I read that it was an abomination to God. And I read it that I was an abomination to God. It was a blow that was incredibly difficult to take. I had been a very precocious, very confident, talkative kid, and I closed up. I couldn't let anybody know who I was, so one of the ways that I reacted to it was that I felt that I had to be little Peter Perfect. I couldn't have any negative attention drawn to me, because then, you know, people could possibly find out. And so I got to be very cautious. I would only do things that I was kind of certain that I could succeed in. Fortunately, I was pretty good in school, and so I became a student. But I didn't dare try anything else where I might possibly fail. As I said, I was a pretty decent student, so I did graduate high school. Went to a consolidated high school, and there were 48 in my class. And we had a pretty big class, really. And then I went to the University of Minnesota. When I was at the U, I still was planning on that I was going to go to the seminary. But I did join a fraternity, and the fraternity I became a part of was one that one of the very important things was that our fraternity had the highest GPA of all the Greek organizations at the university. And that was true of the fraternities and all the other schools where that fraternity is as well. That's one of the important things. And so our fraternity had a large group of good students and a very small group of partiers. I still carried with me a lot of the religious feelings that I had. Drinking was very sinful. And so I really looked down on that small group of partiers. The drinking age at that time in Minnesota was 21. And, uh, So it was on the night before my 21st birthday that my roommate and one of the other guys from the fraternity decided that I needed to see that you could have it could be a decent dinner if you had a drink first. And so the night before my 21st birthday, I had my one drink. And I think it was the only time in my life that I had one drink. Because I didn't do it after that. the next night, which was my 21st birthday, my two best friends from the fraternity and one of my cousins who was also at the university, who was my age, she was 21 too, we went to downtown Minneapolis, and that was my first drunk. I used as my excuse that, well, you know, if we had had alcohol in the house, I would have learned how to have limits and learned how to say, you know, I've had enough. But since I never had that experience, I don't know about limits, and so I managed to get drunk every time I did drink. All of a sudden, very shortly after that birthday, I kind of left that large group of good students in the fraternity and became a part of that little group of partiers. And so thank goodness I had 3 years and one quarter of decent grades, because otherwise I don't think I would have graduated had I continued the way I was in my last two quarters at the U. I did graduate, and I did go to the seminary. While I went to the seminary in Chicago, only occasionally was there any real opportunity to have a drink, and each time that I did, I did get drunk. I had no idea how to stop. You know, once I had one drink, it continued till I was drunk. I got my parish in suburban Detroit. I was ordained, and my parish was in suburban Detroit. Typical of the churches that the new graduates from a seminary get, you're either an assistant to an already successful pastor, or you get a little parish that's probably in a lot of trouble, and if it fails, well, it's no big thing. It was going to fail anyway, so that was what I got. But of course, you know, I'm little Peter Perfect, and so I couldn't let that happen. And so I worked very, very hard, and I, got this little parish that had like about 35 people. And in the first couple of years that I was there, it started to boom, and we started all kinds of things. A Sunday school, women's groups, study groups, a choir. We had a little going concern there in that little congregation. Obviously, I had not dealt with my sexuality at all. I just tried to really keep a lid on that. I worked very hard, and occasionally, once in a great while, I would escape to the anonymity of Detroit and to a bar in Detroit, and then I would be filled with such guilt and shame, and so I'd work all the harder, and then that period when it became a shorter and shorter period when I would make my escape again into Detroit. And I knew that I couldn't continue on like this. And so I went to the bishop thinking the bishop is supposed to be the pastor to the pastors. So I told him I was very honest with him what was going on with me. And from when I told him until I was down in Kansas City, where the Lutheran Church had a program for the pastors that had nervous breakdowns, alcohol problems. It was a grand total of 9 days from when I talked to him until I was down in Kansas City. My self-esteem was, my ego was just smashed. I worked in Kansas City for a little while, and one Sunday I saw an ad in the Kansas City Star, wanted a flight attendant, male or female, for appointment call this number. So on Monday morning I called the number and said, "What's a flight attendant?" And they said, "Well, you know, the job a stewardess does." And I said, "Well, yes." And they said, "Well, that's it." I said, "You mean they're hiring men for that?" And they said, "Yep." I said, "Well, I want an interview." And so on that Wednesday, I had an interview, and I was hired, tentative, of course, if I would pass the physical, which I did. And so on March 3rd, 1973, that is my seniority date, not sobriety date. I started a career of coffee, tea, or me. it was a terrific career. I had every intention of going back into a parish. I had to see a psychiatrist. Well, while I was down in Kansas City, I had to see a psychiatrist every day. And when I got based in Chicago, so when I was up in Chicago, I would go at least once a week and generally twice a week to a psychiatrist, because as long as I could be certifiably straight, I could get back into a parish. And I couldn't do that. I couldn't be certified. And so I continued my career with the airline. It was a wonderful job in many ways. I did get an opportunity to see a lot of the world while at work, and for somebody who wants to escape, who wants to get away from things, not have responsibilities, it's a great job. Because I'm sorry, I can't do that. I'm going to be working. I'm going to be gone. I'll be in Buenos Aires. I won't be in here. So you know, it was very good in many ways. For somebody who just wanted to skate along, alcohol was available, but I did not drink on the airplane. And nor did I take any alcohol from the airplane, because I knew I had to have that job, because I needed the money to pay for what was now becoming quite a problem. So I knew I had to keep my nose semi-clean there at work, so that I could do what I wanted to do, and that was to drink a lot, because I still had not dealt with a lot of things. I had an awful lot of negative feelings. I had a lot of self-hatred. Let's be honest. I hated who I was. And I felt I was an abomination. I really did. And that was such a painful thing, that the alcohol numbed me from those feelings. and I drank more and more. I started to have problems with blackouts, although I had never heard the word. I would start out I would go to one bar and then, you know, have a few drinks and I would kind of lose track of where I was, and I called it surfacing, because then the next time I would surface and know where I was, I would be oftentimes in a different bar. I would be somewhere else. I had no idea how I had gotten there, had no idea where my car was. I spent an afternoon walking around the streets of the north side of Chicago trying to find my car, because I had no idea where it was. The blackouts became much more severe. It got to the point where I was drinking every day that I didn't have to fly. I drank very heavily, and I would black out and sometimes not wake up for a day or two, or know what happened to me for a day or two. I don't know if I continued drinking. I truly don't know. I do not know. It got to the point that I came home from a trip on the 26th of March, and I did what I always did, what I had been doing most of the time. I went straight to my liquor cabinet, made myself a bourbon and water and no ice, because that melted down and diluted. And then started to look at the mail and take off my uniform and whatever. I started this, you know, where I came home from a trip on the 26th of March. The next thing that I knew what was going on, it was the 3rd of April. And that finally scared me enough to actually do something. It was like, you know, this cannot continue. I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I really didn't. But because of the name, I thought it had something to do with alcohol. How bright. And it did. And so I looked in the yellow pages, and I found the number for the downtown office in Chicago, and I called, they wanted to know my name. And I thought this was anonymous. You know, I wouldn't tell my name. And so then they said, well, can we have your phone number so somebody can call you back and get you to a meeting? No. I wouldn't tell them my phone number, because then if they had the phone number, they could figure out who I was, you know, and I certainly couldn't let anybody know that I was an alcoholic, you know, that I was this sinner. You know, one of the major sins was alcohol, you know, and I couldn't let anybody know. Well, that person who was on that phone had the patience of a true saint, because they sat with me on that phone and talked with me till I finally gave him my number. And so for those of you who answer the phone, I have such respect for you, and I hope you never get somebody who was as much of a bastard as I was on that phone. A person called me back almost right away, and he asked me if I could meet him at an Episcopal church that was across the street from Wrigley Field, you know, where the Cubs play. And I said, at 6 o'clock. And I said, sure. And he said, well, can you go without having a drink before? And he told me later that my response to that question was, well, what do you take me for? I was the one that had called it in, right? But what do you take me for? At that first meeting that I went to, all I can remember is I remember everybody was very nice. And we got, because I was, it was my first meeting, I got what was then a beginner's package, which had a where and when in it, and some of the pamphlets. And so after the meeting, I went home and I made myself a bourbon and water and sat down to read some of the literature that I got at that meeting. Made perfect sense to me. and so that night on April 3rd, 1984 was that was my last night of drinking. And I woke up sometime in the afternoon of April 4th, in my own bed at home. I don't remember how I got in there, but that's where I woke up, thank goodness. And then I decided to go back to the where and when and find out when the next meeting was, and I probably better get to a meeting. And so I went to a meeting then that Tuesday night, and I went to a meeting on Wednesday night. And by Thursday, I was starting to go into pretty severe physical withdrawal. Because I had obviously, you know, been very used to drinking every day and drinking a lot every day. And so to absolutely stop, you know, you can put your body through quite a shock. And I did. And so by that Thursday meeting, I was shaking and you know, I couldn't control myself and I was probably even more purple than I am now. it was a speaker meeting, and then in Chicago the meetings were an hour and a half long. A speaker would talk for 45 minutes. There would be a break where we could get coffee, and then we'd discuss afterwards. At the break, he came over to me and he asked, "Are you in a hospital program?" He says, "No." I said, "No." And he said, "Well, you really need to be. You're really very, very physically sick. You need to get to a hospital." Nope, I wouldn't do it. You know, the S in Swede, I think, stands for stubborn. And I certainly have that trait. And so I would not go. And so I got in my car. And then he said, "Well, then you've got to get a sponsor." Get a sponsor. What is he talking about? I have to go to a business and ask them to sponsor me? What? You know, all I can think of is like the bowling team that has, you know, red wing shoes on the back of their shirt. What? You know, do I have to do? Obviously, I did not know a thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. That's clear. And so I got in my car after the meeting to go home, and I remembered something that a relatively recent acquaintance had said, was we abused alcohol, so now we don't use it. So I thought, well, maybe. So I drove over, instead of turning to the left and going home, I turned to the right and went to their place of business. And in front of all the customers, I saw one of the two, and I saw Chris, and so all the grace and charm of somebody who is in their third or fourth day of withdrawal, I go, "Chris, are you an alcoholic?" And he goes, "What?" And he didn't hear me. So I said it louder in front of all of their customers. "Chris, are you an alcoholic?" He grabs me and he takes me to the side. He says, "Myron, what's the matter with you?" And I said, "I don't know." I don't know. I said, I'm just falling apart. I said, are you an alcoholic? If you are, help me. And he did. And he was. And he did. And their business was, if you think back to the 80s, in some of the big cities, there was the revival theaters. We didn't have DVDs and VHS tapes back then, but instead you went to see old movies, movies from the 30s, 40s, and 50s in a revival theater. That was where it was. So Chris, who had been selling tickets to customers, brings me upstairs to the projection booth and says to Bob, here, he's yours, take care of him. And so he did. And when they had shown the final movie that night, they tried to convince me to go into a detox, and I wouldn't. I wouldn't. Because then United Airlines would know that I was a drunk, and you know anybody would know that I was a drunk. Heaven forbid. And so no, I couldn't do that. And so they brought me to their home, and they brought me. They had a bedroom down in the basement, a guest bedroom down in the basement, and that's where they put me. And Bob came downstairs and he said, Myron, you still believe in some kind of a God. Get on your knees and ask him to take away the alcohol problem. And I will tell you very honestly, in my 2 years as a pastor, I never was on my knees and asked for help. But I was so desperate at that point that I was on my knees in that basement room and asked for help. And I had as close to what I can experience, say for me was a white light experience where I knew there was a power that I was praying to, mm-hmm. and that it was a creative power, and that he was the creator and I was the created. And I realized that I didn't have to do this alone. I didn't have to take care of this problem. It was taken away that night. It was an amazing experience. That next day was Friday, and Bob and Chris again tried to talk me into going to the hospital, and I wouldn't. So instead, they found a meeting. And it was the 401 meeting, which met at the Sun-Times building in Chicago. Sun-Times is one of the newspapers, and the meeting met there. And it had a reputation of being kind of a wild and crazy meeting. And here I was, you know, shaking and just in horrible straits. And somebody would make a comment and the whole group would burst out laughing. And then somebody else would make a comment and everybody would laugh. And they finally asked if I wanted to make a comment. And I think I heard it from everybody who was in that room that afternoon I said, you people don't seem to understand how serious this is. Think I was a little self-absorbed? But there was then by Friday of my first week of going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had my sponsors, and I found a home group because I hadn't laughed in about 2 years, and to have people able to laugh, it was amazing, and thus truly began my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was incredibly fortunate. to get the men that became my sponsors, Bob and Chris, that became my sponsors, and to find that 401 group, which they loved me when I couldn't love myself. It was truly miraculous what went on at that meeting. I had to start trying to do. I would not say my. I would say my name is Myron. That was it. I would not admit that I was an alcoholic. I had no trouble admitting to the second half of that first step that my life had become unmanageable. I mean, I had a mess. I was a mess like you wouldn't believe. Take away a little bit of the alcohol and all the emotional mess that was inside here came to the fore. I mean, the alcohol had kept me in such a fog that I didn't know, I had no idea who I was and what was going on for probably the last 2 years of my drinking. Take that away and all of a sudden all I heard was, you know, you're not good enough, you're so evil, you know, all this crap that was going on in my head. I heard that you're supposed to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, your first 90 days. Well, I was such a mess that the only time that I could shut off that noise in my head was while I was in a meeting. And so fortunately I lived in Chicago where there's meetings around the clock. And I would go to a 7 o'clock meeting, I would come home and I would be okay for a little while and then I would, you know, the noise would start again and so I would go to a noon meeting and you know, be okay then for a while, and then I would go to 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock meeting, and I would go to a 7, 8 o'clock meeting, and many, many, many nights I went to the 11 o'clock meetings at the Mustard Seed. I went probably in my first 90 days, I went to probably 350 to 400 meetings because I had to. That was the only way that I could stay alive. That was my only lifeline. After that time, I finally was at the point where I could return to work. I had been on an extended sick list, obviously. And I did return to work. Two of the cities that, at that time, we didn't have any international routes. And two of the cities that I had really misbehaved kind of badly in were Denver and San Antonio. And the first trip that I got assigned when I went back flying, my layovers were Denver and San Antonio. I knew all the places to get in trouble in both places, in both cities, but I didn't know. But the first thing that I did when I got into my layover hotel, before I took off my uniform, was made the phone call to where is the nearest meeting to this hotel in both cities. And so that became my modus operandi when I got into back into flying again. I would go to layovers at every layover. I would go to meetings too. And I certainly continued to go to many, many layover meetings in Chicago. I had, you know, finally, you know, after Bob and Chris kind of demanded it of me that I had to say my name is Myron and I'm an alcoholic. I finally started to maybe believe that I was an alcoholic, but I wanted that out. If I said it, then I couldn't have that out. That, you know, if things got really bad, I could get drunk again, you know. But very honestly, one of the things that I know saved me was that my withdrawal was so rough, physically and emotionally, on me, that I knew I could get drunk again with no problem. but I didn't know if I could ever get myself off of alcohol again. And that fear kept me sober for a long time. I finally had to start, trying to work the steps in my own feeble attempt. And the second one was came to believe in a power greater than myself. And I, of course, now that if you've taken the alcohol out of the equation, to then have to deal with God was, my concept of God was that was, this was the God that had created me, the way I am, with the feelings that I had, with the, and then condemn me for that. It was like, I can't deal with that God. I cannot. And I had rage toward that, what seemed so incredibly unfair to me. And I had rage. It was almost like I was two people. At the same time, every morning I got on my knees and asked that the alcohol problem be taken away today. And at night I would get on my knees again and say thank you that it was for that day. And so I came to see that there was some power, that there was something there. And so I tried to move that to that higher power as my God. That was the beginning of coming in contact with that higher power. I had not dealt with coming to terms with my sexuality at all. And the man who had started the 401 group was a little man. He was about this tall. He was really a kind of a little bantam rooster of a guy. Because when you put a little alcohol in him, he was John Wayne. One of the things that he liked to do when he had enough alcohol in him is that he would go outside the gay bars and beat up the queers as they came out. And so here comes this pathetic person into his meeting that needed what he had to say. And I don't even remember exactly when it was during that first year, but I think it was probably about in January where he took me aside and he said, he saw the horrible struggles that I was going through. And he said, Myron, what is it that is the problem here? And I said, that this is so, it's so sinful who and what I am. And he said, Myron, who created you? And I said, well, God did. And he said, do you think he made a mistake? I said, I don't know. And he said, Myron, maybe the sin that you need to look at is the sin of pride, rather than what you think that is so sinful about, this lust thing that you think is so bad. He said, maybe you need to look at the sin of pride, that you think you know better than God. If he created you and is satisfied with you, maybe you need to look at that. This was from the man that used to beat up the queers. It was like, woo. And the healing began to happen a little bit. I came to accept who I am, and I came to find that there was a pretty loving creative God, a creative power that was very different than what I had been that what I had taken from my background. I had to start looking at myself. At one of the meetings, the Alano clubs that I used to go to a lot, there was a sign up on the wall: "The same man drinks again." And I used to hate seeing that thing, because I knew I had to change, and so I had to do an inventory of myself. I did not follow what's in here that first time that I did it. I couldn't. I just didn't know how to do it. But I had to do some serious looking at myself, at the attitudes that I had toward myself. I had to take a serious look at how I treated people. I had to take a real inventory of my life. And then I had to talk about those things with another person, so that I got the perspective like Kenny did for me, to say, you know, here's maybe what you need to look at is this, instead of thinking that this is so terrible. You need to look at this. This is what part of the problem is. And it was a very freeing experience for me to try to do that fifth step, and it opened me up to all kinds of things, to actually talk with another human being about a very wise man, thank goodness, about what I was finding about myself. And then I had to look at what were the my defects of character that were causing me the problems that I wanted to escape and to escape into that alcoholic fog. And you know, that some of the defects that I found that I didn't like, but that I had to get rid of, were the Peter Perfect. You know, that was very debilitating for me. It didn't allow me any freedom. It didn't allow me to make a mistake. It didn't allow me to be human. I had to get rid of Peter Perfect. That was a real character defect. I had to get over being a victim. And I mean, I could play that victim role great. And man, and what it meant was, hey, you gotta, you know, poor me, poor me, poor me. That I had to get rid of that victim, because that I had played that card way too many times. There were a lot of character defects that I had to get rid of. And I had to then finally start to have some self-esteem and to feel that I was a worthwhile person. Before I could make any amends, to really, really make amends to people. Because as one of the things, you know, when they talk about the amends process, it says something to the effect of, as God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone when we're making our amends. It says, without humble, without being servile or scraping. And man, I played those roles very well, because I didn't feel decent about myself. And so I had to come to realize that I was a worthwhile human being, a good human being, something that I had never, ever thought. That, and then I could probably finally make some amends to some of the people for the things that I did or didn't do that really hurt them. Most of the amends that I tried to make with people were accepted incredibly graciously. Not all, because I had not been the nicest person. I know you find that hard to believe. I'm a little charmer than I am. I had hurt some people a great deal, and not every attempt to make an amend was accepted, and I have to live with that. I have to live with that, and then I get to you know, step 10 where I try to look at how I am actually living and behaving each day, and when I have fallen short and have hurt someone from either what I have done or haven't done, that I then can talk with and try to make that amends. And then it comes to me one of the most incredibly wonderful steps is where we have the opportunity to try to get in touch with maybe what God's will for me is. And that is, you know, to how I can be the Myron that He created me to be. And in line with His will for me right now, but you know, as to what I can do to be that Myron, and to truly be His son, His beloved son. And then it says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And what an incredible, incredible spiritual awakening I've had. I am not an abomination to God. I am His loving and loved, beloved son. Just like every one of you are His beloved son and daughter. It is just to know that. I mean, what an incredible spiritual experience that is. Having had a spiritual awakening. I mean, awakening that I have worth and dignity as a human being. That I can hopefully, with my life, bring that a message of hope to somebody who is still sick and suffering. As desperately as I needed to hear that, maybe I can bring that to the person who is still sick and suffering, that there is a way out. We do not have to destroy ourselves with alcohol or drugs. We can live in the sunlight of the Spirit. What an opportunity! I mean, what a gift that we can do that. One of the places that I have come to really, really love, and I know it's as hokey as it sounds. Yeah, I know you're all just going to go, ugh. There's a little bump in the road between Madison and Orange. Some of you I have posted once on Facebook, and that was some pictures of me by the sign of Radiant Virginia. And the sign is Radiant Way. Radiant Way. It's the way we can all live. We can live in that sunlight of the Spirit. We can live a life that is happy, joyous, and free, because that's the life that God wants for us. It says so in here, and I know it to be true. That's the life that God wants for us, is to be happy, joyous, and free, living on that radiant way. Thank you.